I am honored this morning to introduce Dr. Otis Stevens, who really doesn't need a lot of introduction because when you go to hear him, he's just an awesome speaker and a wonderful person. As he told you, he teaches constitutional law, and I wish I could take his course on Supreme Court decisions. And I just found out, thanks to our former President Granger Ricks, who wasn't able to be with us today, that Otis's new book, Unreasonable Search and Seizure, is now up on the NLS Bard site. So you can download it and read it on your stream or your BookSense or your NLS player, or you can actually ask for the cartridge from your library. So, and of course, Otis is a past president of NABT. He actually talked me into joining back in the 70s when I met him. I actually met him in Boston when he spent a year up at Harvard. And that's how I got into NABT. And he's also past president of ACB. So I'm going to shut up now and introduce Dr. Otis Stevens.
Thank you very much, Marcia.
Well, it's good to be with all of you this morning. And I noticed a number of my longtime friends are here. And I was glad to hear your names called, Carol, McCarl, and Janice, and several other people who are well known to me and to this organization. What I want to talk about primarily is a history of the residential school that I attended in Macon, Georgia, back in the 1950s, the Georgia Academy for the Blind. I'm going to talk a little bit about the residential school movement in general, but mainly I'm going to focus on that school because I think it illustrates many of the issues regarding residential schools 100, 150 years ago down to the present. So I'm going to range rather widely over this subject, and I'm going to try to leave some time for questions and observations that you might have on the residential school movement. To begin with, oh, and I should mention to you that much of what I'm going to say is based on a book that I finally finished. I've been working on this history of the Georgia Academy for the Blind for several years now. Finally finished the book, and it was published this past spring under the title In Touch with Learning, A History of the Georgia Academy for the Blind. And I have made copies of this book available at the ACB store. If anybody's interested in purchasing a copy, I think they're going to sell it for about $15 a copy. And this is in print, but it will be available in other formats very soon now. So I hope you have a chance to take a look at it if you're interested in the residential school movement generally. Let me talk a little bit about the origins of residential schools in the United States. As you probably know, the residential school movement began in Europe late in the 1700s. There was a French social reformer whose name was Valentin Huy, I guess that's the way you pronounce it, H-A-U-Y. Huy, is that the way you say it? Huy, okay, is recognized as the founder of the first such school in Paris in 1784. The residential school movement grew rapidly in Europe with the establishment of educational institutions for the blind in such cities as Vienna, Berlin, and London. It was not until 1829, however, that the first school for the blind was chartered in the United States. Chartered, not opened, that year. That year, 1829, marked the origin of the Perkins School for the Blind in Boston, Massachusetts, now located in Watertown, Massachusetts, of course, originally known as the New England Asylum for the Blind. A lot of these schools were called asylums in those days. Its first students were admitted in 1832, so the school actually opened in 1832. The New York Institute for the Blind opened in New York City in 1831, and the Overbrook School for the Blind in Philadelphia originally known as the Pennsylvania Institution for the Instruction of the Blind, opened in 1832. So we had this movement started in the early 1830s in the United States and spread fairly rapidly. And finally, in 1851, the Georgia Academy for the Blind was established. People like Samuel Gridley Howe were very influential in this early movement. There was a tremendous emphasis on educational reform in the United States during this period, and the education of blind people finally began to get some attention. Blind people had a pretty rough time in terms of education prior to the 1800s, and those who made it somehow, in spite of the absence of schools for blind people, really were rather remarkable people. Now, in addition to Samuel Gridley Howe, such leaders as John Russ, who was the first principal of the New York Institute for the Blind, particularly active in promoting the residential school movement during this period. Once begun, the movement spread rapidly. By the early 1850s, schools for the blind were operating in more than 15 states around the country, the North and South. And the Georgia Academy for the Blind was one of those schools. It was established in 1851 by a group of civic-minded Macon, Georgia citizens in collaboration with a man named Walter S. Fortescue, who lived from 1825 to 1911. He was a blind person who graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. I don't know what he studied there, although some biographical work has been done on him. He taught in college later on. This is in the days before Braille was widely used. He was a very competent blind person, however, in those early days, and was a graduate not only of the University of Pennsylvania, but also of the Pennsylvania, what later became the Overbrook School for the Blind. He was just beginning his long and distinguished academic career and had recently been offered the position of principal at the Tennessee School for the Blind, Penny. He went down to Nashville, Tennessee in late 1850, I guess it was, right toward the end of the year. And when he got to Nashville, he found that there was a a cholera epidemic underway. He arrived in Nashville actually on October 7th, 1850, to take up his new duties as principal of the Tennessee School for the Blind, found this cholera epidemic actively underway, and immediately turned around and went back to Philadelphia. He didn't take the job at all. There is, by the way, a good history of the Tennessee School for the Blind that I was able to draw on for some of this information. Some of you may know about that history. Came out about 15 years ago, I guess. 3 months after Fortescue went back to Philadelphia, they got him moving into the South again. They sent him this time down to Georgia to establish the Georgia Academy for the Blind. In collaboration with a number of civic-minded Macon residents, especially medical people, and under the leadership of a person by the name of Robley Dunglison, who was a member of the faculty of the Pennsylvania School for the Blind and also taught at the Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia. He was a trustee of the Pennsylvania School for the Blind, Pennsylvania Institute. It's interesting to note that before coming to the Jefferson Medical College, I thought this was an interesting factoid, Dr. Dunglison was on the medical faculty of the University of Virginia, where he also served as Thomas Jefferson's personal physician during the last year of Jefferson's life. He sent letters of introduction to two of his former students, Dr. James Mercer Green and his brother, Dr. H.K. Green, both from Macon, who were practicing physicians, and got them to assist in the organizing of the academy. Four students initially enrolled at the academy, which was set up in 1851. The first class is taught in July, almost exactly, 160 years ago this month. I think on July 10th, 1851, the first class was taught in Georgia. This was a private school at that time, but the plan was to teach these students for a short time and then go to the state legislature and seek funding for a state school for the blind, which is what happened in early 1852. And some of the early short histories of the Georgia Academy for the Blind indicate that it was established in 1852. Not right. It was 1851. It was a private school, and the four students who were enrolled there did well under Fortescue's instruction. And in 1852, they were able to get a charter and bring down a great teacher for the Georgia Academy for the Blind by the name of Hannah Gillen. Hannah Gillen was a graduate of the Pennsylvania School for the Blind. She was what we would now call probably a low to middle partial, legally blind, but not totally blind. And at the age of 24, she traveled alone from Philadelphia down to Macon, Georgia, which must in itself have been quite a trip in those days, and served as a member of the faculty of the Georgia Academy for the Blind until her death in 1898. The academy grew slowly but steadily during the 1850s. They had several changes of administrative leadership. And finally, a man named John Williams became principal in 1858 and served until his death in 1898. The school weathered a number of difficult challenges during the 1860s, 70s, 80s, right on through the century. The major crisis, I suppose, that the school faced was the Civil War, the American Civil War. The school, located in Macon, Georgia, had just moved into a brand new building, which they finally got approved and constructed. Had been in the building only a few months when Georgia seceded from the Union. There was tremendous support in Macon, as you might imagine, for the Confederacy, and the principal of the academy was himself a strong Southern supporter. Himself a graduate of Emory College, a sighted person with no previous experience in the blindness field, but who learned quickly. In any event, we see in his reports to the state legislature and the governor each year, they provided annual reports. And much of the history that I wrote is based on these annual reports. He pointed out that the school was there as an educational institution. It was not an asylum, was not meant as a place where blind people would simply come for refuge, but education. That was the sole objective, and it took a long time. In fact, I'm not sure that he was ever fully successful in convincing all the people of Macon and Georgia that this is what the school was all about. In any event, by 1863, as the Confederacy began to weaken toward the middle of the war, after the Battle of Gettysburg and after the battles around Chattanooga in the fall of 1863, and just before Sherman began his invasion of Georgia the next spring, the governor of the state wrote to the principal of the Georgia Academy for the Blind, this very tactful letter, said, we would appreciate your allowing us to use your building as a hospital for wounded veterans or for wounded soldiers, Confederate soldiers. Well, this was no invitation that you could turn down, or no request that you could turn down. It was really an order that the school be turned over to the Confederate government, and that's what happened. They vacated the premises, moved the school, teachers, students, administration, the whole bit, down to a smaller town in Georgia, Fort Valley, Georgia, southwest of Macon, and there the school remained throughout the Civil War period until the end of the war. They moved back to Macon. By that time, the hospital, the Confederate hospital, which had been the building had been used as a Confederate hospital, had been turned over to the Union, which had finally captured Macon. And for the last few months of the war, it was a Union hospital. Well, you can imagine what kind of condition this building was in after the Civil War. It was a wreck. And the principal and teachers had to come back and clean the place up, get it opened again, which they did for the fall 1865-1866 school year. From then on, the school began to prosper. They established a vocational program teaching primarily chair caning, mat making, not piano tuning at that time. That didn't come until much later. But really developing quite a good vocational program, as well as a strong academic program, which Hannah Gillen led. Well, the story of the school during the 19th century is one of steady, slow but steady growth. And one of the most important developments that took place, all this, of course, was in the period toward the end of slavery. The abolition of slavery, of course, coming during the Civil War period, or at the end of the Civil War period, and all the students of the academy, with a few exceptions, being white people. There were a few black students who were admitted to the vocational part of the academy even before a separate school for black students was finally established in 1882. The interesting thing is that they were willing to take black students as vocational students even before establishing a separate school. But segregation, the Jim Crow era, was well established in the South by the late 1870s, and the Black Academy, as it came to be called, was opened in 1882. The school remained segregated. The two units of the school remained racially segregated from 1882 until the mid-1960s. In the aftermath of Brown versus Board of Education, the school finally desegregated, and over a period of several years, desegregated not only the classroom program, not only the academic program and the vocational program, but also the residential aspect of the school, which was a major step. That was a major social change in the South, in central Georgia in the 1960s and early 70s. And one of the most successful, I would say, one of the most successful efforts to integrate an entire school system, residential and academic. There were some great teachers at the academy during this period. In addition to Hannah Gillen, there was a man named E.H. McNeil who taught music at the academy until his death in 1931. He was there for about 25 years teaching piano and pipe organ primarily. Later on in the 20th century, there were some great teachers whom some of us got to know personally. One of the most outstanding was a blind person by the name of Frank Pursley, who taught piano at the academy from 1944 until 1958. He died at an early age, a kidney disorder in the period before kidney dialysis, and was taken from us at an early age. A number of other outstanding teachers, some of whom, by the way, attended ACB conventions and even were members of the National Association of Blind Teachers, in particular Jerry Pye from Macon, Georgia, and Hazel Hughes, who were teachers at the academy. The question, of course, was why a residential school? Why not integrate kids into the public schools? There were, even in the 1800s, advocates of what later came to be known as mainstreaming, but they were in the minority at that time, and the paradigm for educating blind people, as you know, I'm sure, during that period, was to have people go to a central location within each state, at least one school for the blind, and be instructed there. It was hard to persuade parents to send their young children to the residential school, and it was always a struggle to get word out that the school was there, that it had a lot to offer, although its leaders kept urging early admission of blind students. They say, you want to get the kid into school at an early age, you'll have much more of an impact on him or her at an early age than you will later on. Well, that was a constant struggle for the principal, Williams, of the Georgia Academy for the Blind, and his co-workers at the academy. Money was also a problem. They had very, very small budgets. They subsisted on what, even in that period of time, were tiny salaries, in many cases under $1,000 a year. Even if you discount for inflation and all that sort of thing, under $1,000 a year in 1875 was no huge salary. The way they survived, of course, was that most of the people lived on campus. Most of the people who taught at the residential schools for the blind in that period, including the Academy for the Blind, lived on campus, had free room and board and laundry. And that enabled them to subsist on these small salaries. You see figures during the 1870s and 80s in which the superintendent or principal of the school, as he was then called, would say, we can take care of the entire needs of this school with 75 students, or however many they had at that time, and all of our faculty for, say, $12,000 or $13,000 a year. Unbelievable. And that would include not only the white school, but the black school as well. This figure gradually rose. By the early 20th century, they were up to as high as $18,000 a year. And prior to the Depression, prior to the Great Depression of the 1930s, the annual budget of the Academy actually got as high as $50,000 a year. That was a huge budget for that school. During the Depression, however, the money was cut back, and the school subsisted on $30,000 to $35,000 a year up into the 1940s. I've been talking nonstop for a while here. Now, let me stop and see if you have some questions at this point. There are many, many things we can cover here, but I wanted to give you some idea of what the school was experiencing. And this school was typical, I think, of many schools for the blind around the country. So do you have any questions at this point?
When you were doing
yes.
research for this book, Dr. Stevens, did you use, I assume you used the school records.
Such as they were. There weren't very many. Yeah.
And document analysis is one of my main research tools. I think that older documents are fascinating. What other sources did you use for your research?
There were annual reports prepared by the principal of the school, and there were also annual reports prepared by the Board of Trustees. The Academy for the Blind had a separate voluntary Board of Trustees, and those reports, those annual reports, were turned over to the legislature of the state and ultimately the governor of the state. Or I guess it was the governor and then the legislature. And they contained the requests for funding. They also contained descriptions of what was going on at the school during the preceding year and lists of students. We have lists of students who were enrolled at the academy during all those years of the second half of the 19th century and into the 20th century.
When did Braille come in?
Braille came in at the academy only after 1900, actually. They had New York Point, which began in the early 1870s. And they also taught moon type, kind of a variation of print that was taught as an early means of communication. Braille, you're familiar with I think there was a book called The Battle of the Dots, or
yes.
You remember that? The Academy for the Blind went through that with New York Point being more popular at first than Braille. Braille finally emerging after 1900. And then after World War I, Braille became the universal code used around the country. But it wasn't until that late date, actually, that Braille established its primacy.
Well,
Other questions you might have?
Did you ever know if there was a farm related to the school?
A farm?
Raising of
yes. They tried, the first building that the school occupied was on a fairly small tract of land, 2 or 3 acres only, a couple of acres that toward the middle of Macon, downtown Macon. They were there from 1860 until 1905. And then they moved out to Vineville Avenue, where the school is currently located, with about 25 acres. And they tried to use some of that land for growing for a big garden and to produce some of the food for the school. They also raised hogs, slaughtered hogs there for a while, had chickens for a while, even had a poultry program for blind students briefly at the academy. They tried that as a means of vocational training. Didn't work out too well because it was probably underfunded. They also started a greenhouse program at the academy back in the 1950s, and that program is still going on. It's cut back to some extent. But they were trying all these things to enhance the support for the school, including the growing of vegetables, and the slaughtering of hogs. They even got into the cattle business briefly, but they could never apparently pull that off too well. Politics entered into the administration of the academy, unfortunately, during the 1940s and 50s. It's a rather turbulent period when the governor of the state would name the superintendent of the Georgia Academy for the Blind, and every time the governorship changed hands, you'd have a change in the superintendent's office. At that time, and this is spelled out in some detail in the book, the Democratic Party was prominent in the South, in Georgia, and being elected, winning the Democratic primary was tantamount to being elected to the office. So there was there were a couple of bitterly opposing factions in Georgia during this period, some supporting a popular governor by the name of Eugene Talmadge, later his son Herman Talmadge, and the other being the anti-Talmadge faction. Every time the Talmadge people took over, they would kick out whoever the superintendent of the academy was. And when the opposite happened, then they would the new superintendent would come in and kick out the pro-Talmadge leader of the academy. So the academy was thrust into politics. It was described as a political football for about a dozen years during the 40s and into the 50s. Finally, in around 1950, 51, they were able to separate the appointment of the superintendent of the academy from outright political maneuvering, made it kind of a merit system appointment, and achieved a lot greater stability during that time. The academy had a strong musical program all the way along. They had a lot of people who were successful in the field of music. They had a number of people, even though they didn't have high school graduation at the academy until the 1940s. I mean, they didn't have a full high school program until sometime in the early 1940s. Nevertheless, with their 10-grade program, they often sent students straight from the academy to places like Mercer University, the University of Georgia, and other colleges around the state. So a lot of people from the academy went on to college. A number of them went into other fields of work. Especially successful was the piano tuning and repair program that started in the early 1900s and lasted until mainstreaming finally pushed it aside by the late or mid-1980s. And part of this book talks about the impact of mainstreaming on the academic programs at the academy, academic and vocational programs. The impact of mainstreaming, of course, on those programs was devastating. Though the academy still offers what they call a 12-grade program leading to high school graduation, it does not have the high academic standards that were prevalent in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. This mainstreaming movement really got underway big time in the mid-1970s and transformed the academy. And a lot of people would say that while it was admirable to try to in some ways integrate blind students into the public school curriculum, a lot was lost there. A lot of independent teaching of independence, extensively emphasized Braille instruction was de-emphasized, and much of it was lost with the mainstreaming revolution. And the residential school movement, as you know today, is seriously threatened by all of this. And residential schools in a number of states have already been closed. On the other hand, there are those out there, and some of you are probably better able to talk about this than I am, but I have sensed, and from what I have read and heard people say, there is now a growing recognition of the uniqueness of a residential school experience for blind students, and some desire to bring it back, at least in part, to allow students to experience living pretty much on their own in a residential school setting. And that is an interesting development. We don't know what's going to happen with that. But the mainstreaming revolution is not over by any means, and there is a bit of a counter-revolution, it seems to me, underway right now.
Otis?
Yes. Oral?
Yeah.
I think I heard you over there. Yes.
Question for you.
Yeah.
As you know, in the early days of the residential schools,
yes,
such people as Dr. Samuel Gridley Howe went out missionizing.
Yes, and that happened at the Georgia Academy for the Blind.
That's my question. Because
yes.
Dr. Howe frequently would take a couple of these students, and mm-hmm. I'm sure people from the other early residential schools, and they traveled horrendous distances in those days, such as all the way out to the upper Ohio Valley. Because in the early histories of schools like Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee,
yep.
there were visits by Dr. Howe and his students
yep.
with the state legislatures.
And that happened at the Academy. Yes, that happened at the Academy for the Blind.
That was my question, is whether he
absolutely
hit Georgia in the process also.
I don't know that Howe actually came to Georgia, but people who were his disciples
yes.
were right there. There was an early leader of the Academy by the name of Robert Smith, a young, energetic fellow who had an entree with the legislature, and he organized several programs for presentation to the legislature. And he would take the teachers and the students over, and they would conduct musical performances and even go through examinations before the legislature and answer questions on math and geography and so on. On display. Now, that would be regarded by many people today as quite demeaning, but in those days it was a way of drawing attention to the educational needs of blind people and drumming up support for the Academy. And this was true all over the country. They started a fund, just sort of passed the hat after one of these performances, a student fund in the mid-1850s in Georgia, which grew and grew and grew to several many thousands of dollars, in fact, and was used to help students when they left the Academy to get started in business or whatever they went into. So this idea of learning about the Academy through performances, which Samuel Gridley Howe led the way on, was definitely true at the Academy.
We that
yes.
In the
1960s?
Yes.
So this went on for a long time. Let me read you just a paragraph or two which describes some of this work. On March 6, 1856, Smith was a secretary of the Board of Trustees. He was later killed, by the way, in a Civil War battle. He became a colonel and was killed in the Battle of 7 Days near Richmond in 1862, tragically. But he was a tremendous supporter of the early Academy. On March 6, 1856, Secretary Smith reported that the General Assembly of Georgia had appropriated an additional $20,000 for the erection of a new building, based largely on the performances of students before the Academy, before the legislature. So that was, it was well known that these students were out there to help promote the academy and its mission. And that was a very, very important aspect of its growth that contributed enormously to the growth of the academy.
Otis?
Yes.
You mentioned the vocational, and I think you said music.
Yes.
Okay. Were there programs on physical education, sports?
There were later. They began late in the 1800s. They did begin to recognize the need for physical education. In fact, this early principal, Williams, William Williams, that was his, I was trying to remember his first name. William Desmukes Williams was his name. He got the physical education program underway, and his son, Dudley Williams, who succeeded him for a couple of years as principal of the school, went further in promoting physical education. So by the early 1900s, they were actually employing teachers of physical education, that far back. And one of the superintendents, John Herndon, in the 1940s, had been a former high school football coach. So when he came to the academy, he really emphasized physical education, had the boys and, to some extent, the girls playing ball and competing in intramural competition in football. And of course, we had our own ways of playing football and baseball. I don't know whether any of you experienced this or not, but we had a system of playing football which enabled totally blind kids to participate. They participated playing alongside the partially sighted kids, but the partially sighted kids were the ones who threw passes and got to run the football. The blind guys were on the line banging heads together and not getting very far with. So we decided, those of us who were totally blind, that we would have our own totally blind game. You had to be totally blind to qualify to play this game. And we would limit each offensive play to no more than 10 yards. So that, you know, if a person got around the line, he could run all the way to the goal line untouched. So we limited the play to 10 yards per play. And we had no sighted people helping us, no beepers either in those days. So when we kicked off, sometimes it took 5 or 10 minutes to find the ball. But we did it. We wanted to be our own players, fully participating. So this idea of full participation by blind people in athletic events, and Oral, you know a lot more about athletic events than I do, but I think this shows that blind kids were into this sort of thing way back. They wanted to participate, and they found ways to do it.
Did the academy? Video
games. I'm sorry.
I have totally blind kids that can play video games.
Really? Video games. Okay.
That's where the participation is going today.
Yeah, with the video game revolution that we're in now. There was a question over here on the left, I believe.
Nyetta.
Yes, Nyetta.
The Georgia Academy, was it part of the EAAB, Eastern Athletic Association?
I think it was. It was for a time, and they had a lot of athletic competition beginning in the 1960s. They went to tournaments all around the South involving many schools for the blind. That was a very active movement for a number of years, again, until mainstreaming tended to curtail those activities. Also, the Academy was very active in literary events, competing in debate, declamation, essay writing, and musical competition with the public schools. So that, for example, when I was a student at the Academy, we competed in all those areas at the state level, at the district level, and the state level, and won a lot of contests in music and in debate, in declamation, in essay writing, and
actually, in North Carolina, we also competed in wrestling.
Yes, and they did in wrestling and in bowling and swimming at the Academy, and track. They had track meets as well. This was well developed in the 1960s and into the early 70s. The school really flourished during that period, by the way. It really had produced some very successful graduates who went on to do impressive things.
I would like you to make a couple of comments. I hope I'm not putting you on the spot on this, but we had talked about the topic being residential schools, past, present, and future.
Yes.
Could you make a couple of comments about where, in your research, you've seen things going, in the past? Because as Santiago said, he who does not learn from his history is destined to repeat it. But what your perspective on what is going to happen and what needs to happen in the future?
Well, my reading of it, and this is just one person's opinion, my reading of it is that the residential school movement was very successful for those people who were able to take advantage of it, but it never got out to all people who could benefit from it. They had a tremendously difficult time recruiting students down through the years, so that the residential schools never reached all the people who could have benefited from their programs. I think that provided some impetus for mainstreaming. Unfortunately, mainstreaming, by de-emphasizing through no deliberate action, but just as a matter of circumstance, de-emphasizing the teaching of Braille, the teaching of Braille reading and writing skills, really hurt educational opportunities for a number of blind kids. And the future, as I see it, is to try to regain some of the value that can come from the residential school experience. As I say, I think there is a growing recognition on the part of educators that there is something of value in having blind kids pretty much given independence within the school setting to do for themselves and not to have other people doing everything for them, parents in particular. And to the extent that the educational system is recognizing that the residential school experience can be of value to blind children, we may see some rejuvenation of this model. I don't know. I'd like to think so. But it certainly has been transformed since the mid-1970s and is today nothing like what it was at its peak during the 1960s and early 70s. Does that sort of get at your question?
Yes, and it's sort of interesting. It's a loaded question. I was mainstreamed starting in 10th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I would recommend that model, going to residential school, getting the basics.
Absolutely. And that's what a lot of people
were here.
Because when I went to public school, right. I was the first and only blind kid in the whole school district. My itinerant teacher saw me an hour a week. She just told me I can't.
But you were ready. You were ready. And that's what the old residential schools were preparing kids to do that if they chose to do it. And a lot of people were, in fact, going from about the 9th or 10th grade on in the public schools, having gotten a great foundation at the residential school. That was probably the preferred model, in fact. In any event, very complicated field, very complicated questions being asked, and a lot of funding decisions having to do with local funding and the advantages that local communities have in keeping kids in their local school systems. That's part of it as well. Well, thank you very much for your attention, and I'm going to turn it back over to Carl. Thank you.
Let's give him a hand.